today is September 5th, 2020, and my guest today is Alex. How are you?
Good, Margaret. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing well. What were your plans, or what did you do today?
A lot of water involved in today's day. Took the kids to a splash pad, and then a little while ago, we went to the swimming pool. So I've just been trying to keep them busy this Labor Day weekend.
Okay, I didn't know the splash pad was open, actually. I thought, I was like, whoa, with everything going on, I was like, okay.
You'd be surprised. We decided to turn away from the first one that we came across because we felt like there was too many people there. But we came across the neighborhood one that was empty, and it seemed to fit the need.
Okay, well, that's good. So I'm happy you got to spend time with your kids and you're relaxing. And we can just get through these questions. And I think even like going through these questions when we went over them, I think it's a lot of things that are going on right now. And a lot of it's what we don't really talk about in the podcast. Like the previous episodes, we went like deep and, you know, things like that with, I guess more of like the fluffy side. And I think right now we're going more into like, okay, like this is what's going on. Like this is what's the, like the reoccurring problem, and I think it's just been surfacing right now this year, like more heightened.
That's right. You know, like right now there's, you know, we're a couple months into the pandemic and everybody's kind of coming to the realization that this isn't going away anytime soon. I think a lot of the people who were a little more cautious in February, you know, were talking about, oh, this is what we're looking at, worst case scenario in September and October. And, you know, here we are in September. And, you know, I think a lot of people are just realizing now that that worst case scenario is a very likely possibility. So I kind of wanted to talk about a couple things that, you know, have been at the forefront of my mind as someone who's, you know, a citizen of this country and who's identifies as a moderate, you know, someone who tries to, you know, really think through and, you know, form my opinions based off of, you know, not only the knowledge that I possess, but, you know, what other people say. And I always try to challenge my beliefs. So that's what I'm hoping to bring to tonight's discussion, is just, you know, a little bit of my perspective on kind of how I see things, and hopefully your listeners, you know, can take upon it and think critically about what my words say and if they agree or disagree. I'd like to just forward the discussion because I don't feel like, to these days at least, I just don't feel like people have that dialogue where, you know, you open up, you know, you have an open-ended question and you open it up to see what other person's opinion is, and too quickly, you know, we move to shut other people down if their opinion differs from us.
Yeah, I think right now it's especially happening now where someone, even right now, I kind of feel like I have to mince my words a lot to like a lot of people, where like I think previously, you know, it wasn't like that. And then now it's like, oh, like, why did you say that? And I'm like, huh? Like, okay, it's just kind of weird. And then when my opinion is different from the other person, that person gets upset. And, you know, I think we should come to a place where we can respect each other's opinion without getting, you know, I guess like too deep into it, because everyone has different opinions and no one's going to think exactly like you.
Exactly. People are just too emotionally charged in their, you know, their opinions. And like, I'm always hesitant to use the word opinion these days, because it feels like these days people have more of a belief of what they think. And what I say belief, because when you believe something, you're willing to hold it as truth even without proof. And you know, when somebody comes and challenges something you believe, it's often they're challenging, you know, your basis for, you know, why you're declaring that is a truth to you. So these days, when you say someone's opinion is incorrect, they get emotionally charged because you're in essence challenging what they believe to be true and what they use to bring meaning to their worldview. And that's why they get angry. And that's why, I mean, you hear about it all the time. People, I'm not sure if it still happens. You know, I stay away from social media, but, you know, my friends tell me how they're, you know, they're somebody on their social media was like, oh, all Trump voters, I'm cutting you off. Or, you know, and someone else is like, all Bernie Sanders voters or whatever, you know, yeah, it's Biden now. No, but at the time it was Bernie Sanders. So I'm cutting everybody who likes Bernie Sanders out of my life. I'm just thinking to myself, why would you do that? You know, why are you, you know, if you really want to have that dialogue, why would you want to cancel out that other person?
Right.
But going back to what I was saying, they do that because that other person is challenging their belief. You know, right, they believe what they believe to be true. And only person that can change that is the person who holds on to that. Mm-hmm. So it's just a very difficult time these days.
Yeah, well, it's funny you bring that up because I remember, I think it was almost a year ago, we went to that book, that remember that book discussion event? And the author, I forgot her name, but remember, I don't know if you remember this, but she was like, I'm just gonna like unfollow all like Trump supporters. And obviously I don't really support Trump, but I'm like, I don't know if I'm just gonna go down the list and just unfollow somebody because of what they believe in, like politically.
No, absolutely. And that was the discussion with Robert E. Lee the third.
Yeah.
Correct?
Yeah. And that, yeah, I forgot the other lady's name though.
No, we'll look it up, but I definitely remember that part, and it just struck me as just very, for someone who was putting themselves as an educated person, it struck me just as odd that someone who I perceived as educated would completely cut off, you know, a form of, you know, discussion. That person may not agree with you, but they may have valid points. You'd cut that all off just because they don't agree with you. That just,
yeah,
struck me as odd. You know, and it's funny you bring that up because I was thinking about that the other day. That particular forum, because Robert E. Lee the third, do you remember? So throughout the discussion, he was talking about how he was apologizing, you know, for being a white man. He apologized a couple times throughout his remarks. And I remember when he opened it up to discussion, I had asked him, well, why do you feel like you need to apologize? And his answer was pretty, I felt like, a pretty good explanation. He felt like he needed to apologize because he wanted to show the people that he was empathizing, and not only sympathizing with the cause, that he understood, mm-hmm, you know, the oppression that had happened throughout the hundreds of years of American history, and that that was his way of being able to reject the, you know, that he understood that.
Mm-hmm.
And but for me, I think that I kind of want to talk about that a little bit. The I'm sorry mentality that I feel like a lot of Americans feel like they need to have,
yeah,
when it comes to certain things that are happening throughout the world, like, you know, police brutality and, you know, different things that have happened throughout history. How, you know, American history hasn't been the nicest, but neither has any other civilization that has come and gone. And we have black marks on our history that we just have to understand was a different time, and we've learned from it and we're moving on. But I feel like there's a section of the population that feels like they have to apologize for something they took no part in. And then there's that section that also feels like they have to apologize, but they're angry about it. Mm-hmm. And it was very striking to hear, you know, Robert E. Lee III, you know, his answer as to why I apologize, but it just kind of opened up, you know, a whole new thing that I didn't really think about at the time, because for me, my perspective is very different. It isn't, you know, I'm not a white man in America. I'm, you know, I'm a Mexican American in America. And so my experience has been very different. So it was just, I didn't see it from his perspective, so I couldn't understand why he saw it that way.
I mean, I saw it in his way because I feel like, because his like uncle and like his bloodline, like they were a part of, you know, like during that era. So that's why I feel that he, I don't know, he kind of has to like apologize for what his uncle and like the actions he did, because his uncle was, is kind of like, I don't know, he, his uncle is kind of a big deal. So that's why I feel like from his perspective, that's why he's like apologizing, because his uncle kind of caused, or his, not uncle, his like great, great uncle just caused like a lot of like problems.
Yeah, and I get that, but I honestly think that the apologizing is the wrong, I think it's the wrong olive branch to extend, because mm-hmm. it's done as a way to extend the olive branch to those that have been oppressed, and to say to them, hey, I get it, let me help you. But mm-hmm. from the other side, like, I don't think there, it's being seen the same way on the other side that it's being, you know, it's being intended. Mm-hmm. So I always felt like that was the wrong way. Maybe an I understand, or I don't understand, but I want to help. Something like that, to me, I think would extend the conversation further than I'm sorry, you know. And then the person's like, well, what are you sorry for? You didn't have slaves, you know, you didn't oppress people, you weren't doing terrible things to African Americans in the early 1900s. Like, what do you have to apologize for? And that's where the discussion stops. I feel like if we just said, you know, I don't understand, but I'd like to help, or I understand and I'd like to help, I think that's where we can forward the discussion, mm-hmm. you know, to get some understanding on American history. So, I do want to touch a little bit on that particular topic.
Okay.
American history, just in general. So this was something that I've kind of been thinking about over the last year, just kind of with the turmoil of, you know, the multiple very, very present police killings, you know, towards one particular portion of the American community, and how we seem to be encountering the same problems every 30 years. Now follow me here. So it's 2020, we have racial unrest in dozens of cities, you know, people, you know, going out armed, people causing destruction, and we see the images everywhere.
Yeah,
you know, it's something that we're going to be, you know, telling our children. But let's rewind a bit and think back to another time where this may have happened. And at least in my lifetime, I was too young to understand that at the time, but since I've looked into it a little bit, and that was the Rodney King incident that happened in the early 90s. So for those who are unfamiliar with it, Rodney King was someone who had committed a crime, and the police got him. And essentially, I'm not sure if it was the first time, but somebody got it on camera where the police were beating him with nightsticks. And people wanted, you know, those police officers brought to justice, because this, to a lot of people at the time, and tell me if you see parallels, was indicative of a problem with policing in America, that the African-American community at the time was being policed too hard, and oftentimes the police would use excessive force on the African-American community. So these four police officers were used as, you know, these cops need to be made an example of. And the trial went through about a year later, and these four cops were acquitted. Even with the video evidence, these cops were still acquitted of their charges, and essentially Los Angeles erupted into riots. For your listeners, you can look up the Watts riots. It was a time of high unrest. The National Guard was called, like hundreds of buildings burned, people were killed. You know, it was just something that really is parallel to, you know, what's going on right now. It took a couple weeks before it quieted down, but I mean, the damage was done. You know, an article I read a few years back, I'm not sure if things have changed, But an article I read a few years back, you know, stated that a lot of the damage that was done was never repaired. So we see a lot of parallels, and that was the same situation. It was the violence was kicked off by, an incident with the police. And I want to rewind a bit more, you know, like that's, I'm skipping over a lot, but let's go back to the 60s. You know, like I was looking into the, because of all this, I looked into the civil rights movement and the riots and everything that came about in the 60s that led to the civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of parallels involved. I'm just going to highlight one example. In the 60s, the Black Panthers, mm-hmm. I believe it was in July, marched. I believe it was like July of 1965, mm-hmm. marched on the capital of Sacramento. At the same time that, at the time, it was Governor Ronald Reagan was the governor of California. And he was holding a press conference on one side of the Capitol building. And on the other side of the Capitol building were the Black Panthers. And they, at the time, California did not have restrictions on open carry. So they were openly carrying assault rifles. Mm-hmm. Well, the optics of Governor Reagan, you know, being juxtaposed with the Black Panthers, mm-hmm. you know, and he's supposed to be saying, you know, I have order and everything, really, really resonated throughout the state. And as a result, Governor Reagan passed an open carry ban, which was intended to curb the Black Panthers openly carrying assault rifles, because not only at the time were the Black Panthers doing that, but they were also, you know, following police, because at the time during the 60s, we had the same issue, mm-hmm. you know, heavy policing in African-American communities. Mm-hmm. So they were at the time following the police, you know, making sure that they were doing their job with assault rifles in hand. In their view, they were doing a community service. But that was all stopped when Governor Reagan passed that assault rifle, the open carry ban. So, yeah. I mean, if we've been here before is what I'm trying to get at. And I believe it's because the history that we've been taught in school is really not the history that's like happened, because I tried almost to think back. I mean, I tried to think back to what I can remember about the era between 1865 and 1920, basically from, you know, the end of the Civil War, the beginning of Reconstruction, and takes us to world when the U.S. entered World War One, and I can't remember much being taught about that. Actually, we kind of just went from, you know, Civil War's over, we expand west, World War One, and then the Roaring Twenties, the stock market crash, World War Two, Korea, Vietnam, and so on and so forth. So there was like a huge gap of information missing. Well, you know, look back into that section of history and you come to find out that John Wilkes Booth had political motivations to assassinate President Lincoln. There was, you know, he had his own motivations, but it was a lot deeper than just, you know, some guy going into Ford's Theater and killing Lincoln. And then you look at after the Civil War was over, and you know, Reconstruction was the era that it was called. And there were plenty of states in the South that actively worked against it. And there was what, Plessy versus Ferguson, mm-hmm. that passed? So like, there was a lot of things that happened during that time that, you know, even though the Civil War ended and supposedly slavery was over, but African Americans at large were still considered a second class. Mm-hmm. Especially in the South, with Jim Crow passing, a lot of these places, the legislature, even though they could vote, you know, Black people's vote didn't matter. They started passing poll taxes. They started making people take tests to vote. You know, they passed Jim Crow. They did segregation. They did all of this stuff that we just gloss over. We completely gloss over it for our children. We're doing our children an absolute disservice by glossing over all this stuff, because then we get to now where we come across people who've been taught this version of history, and you tell them, you know, we have statistics that show that African Americans, you know, have more encounters with the police, and those encounters tend to be deadlier than encounters, you know, with Caucasians mm-hmm. and the police. And it has to do with like hundreds of years of history, and not to mention like things we just have glossed over and don't talk about. Like, why do we continue to have these problems 30 years, every 30 years it seems to happen? Because what, 2020, then we got 1990, and then we got 1960s. So like what, 30 years before that, did something happen in the 1930s that we weren't taught about? You know, 30 years before that, there was like, there's just so much about our history that I feel like we've been robbed of as far as learning. Because I mean, you can look at it any way you want, but you got to ask yourself the question, why haven't we been taught this history? Why do you have to go out and seek it? Because I've had to go out, I'm sure you've had to do the same when looking into Reconstruction and how the South really moved against, you know, voting rights and making sure that Black people couldn't own property. And there was, you know, that wasn't taught to me in school. I mean, yeah. I didn't learn that until much later.
I'm sorry to cut you off, but I was just going to say that I think a lot of what we were taught in school is, it's not exactly like 100% accurate, because I do recall that I remember we were taught, I think it was like in elementary school. I think it was like elementary school, and they were saying, this is just like one example where they were saying that this is like Thanksgiving. And they were saying that, oh, like the Europeans came on like a ship, and like the natives were there, and then they had like a really nice dinner for Thanksgiving. Like that's just like one example. And then like you read about it and everything, and it's just not. And even like Native history is just not taught a lot in school. It's just like a very brief segment that's pretty much like inaccurate. And these were like the first people that were here. So why don't we know much about it? Or why is this kind of like, you know, Pat, like it's not really seen? And that's just like one example. And then what you were talking about, this is just like in regards to like the criminal justice system. So like one recent movie that came out last year, did you see When They See Us?
When They See Us? No, I did not.
It's so basically it's about they were called like the Central Park Five. This was in the 80s. And four of them were African American, and then one of them was like Hispanic. And they were at a park, they were at Central Park, and police caught them because there was like a rape incident. And they basically tried their best to frame them as best as they could. And they took them out, and pretty much they were at the police station for like over 24 hours with like no food, no water. They were just interrogated, and they were underage as well. And they were pretty much trying to make them confess that they raped this woman. So they were in jail for like pretty much almost 10 years. And these were like young kids that were like 16, 17 years old. And then later on, they found out that it was like another guy, and pretty much the city of New York gave them $45 million. And it was, but it was like split between five of them, $45 million.
I'm very familiar with the Central Park Five. I've actually looked into it incidentally a few years back, and it's exactly as you said. I'm not sure if they went into this in the movie, but one of the details that I do remember about that is our current president, Donald Trump, after these boys were released, took out a full-page ad in the New York Times, essentially calling for these five boys at the time to be arrested without proof.
Yeah, this was in the movie.
Oh, was it? Okay.
Yeah, there was like a brief segment that he did that. And then Yeah, so the fact that people like support him is just, I don't know. It's, I mean, obviously everyone has their own opinion, but these are, this is just one example of, it's just like, okay, well, why?
Right, exactly. Well, I mean, getting back to American history and kind of the questions that you're asking are the same questions I'm asking, which are, why are we taught this revisionist history that doesn't really, you know, doesn't glosses over a lot of what happened, and why is it taught to us that way? So like, is there a reason? Is it because they're ashamed of it, or is there, you know, something, you know, more to think about? Where are we heading? You know,
I don't think it's like a shame. Like, I think each country has their own like dark history, just like we have like certain parts that's like dark and then other countries do, but I just think that they don't want the public knowing like the whole truth. Like, because it's like, you know, when they had Columbus Day, and clearly like they're trying to get rid of Columbus Day in most states, but they're just trying to like cover up the truth in certain things. Like, they want the system to be set up a certain way for like for certain people to fail, if that makes sense.
No, I absolutely, it makes sense. It's I'm glad you brought up the subject of, you know, trying to hide things and trying, you know, things that countries wouldn't want to draw attention to, because it leads me into the next subject that I really wanted to talk about, and that's the continued separation of families at the border. Mm-hmm. By the Trump administration, even after he had rescinded the order, supposedly, to stop separating families. So I do want to give a little bit of history and context on this, because there is, like, I feel like there's a certain narrative that's been created over the past couple of years to lead people to believe that a certain thing is currently happening that mm-hmm. isn't. So, shortly... Jeez, when did the caravan come? There was a couple caravans. So Central America is currently being rocked by lots of violence, lots of gang violence. People mm-hmm. are being kidnapped. Basically, you know, south of the border isn't the safest place for to travel or even to live. Mm-hmm. And mostly Central, a lot of people are coming from Central America to escape. Now, after... I believe it's after World War II, certain protections were put in place for refugees that were to be recognized internationally, that if somebody was claiming refugee status and they could prove, you know, that they were escaping imminent harm and that they were, you know, they feared for their lives, then you could be gained entry into the United States on refugee status. And there's a lot of people who have taken advantage of that, and not necessarily advantage in the sense that they're doing something that they shouldn't, but, you know, rightfully so. If you are in a situation where you don't feel safe, you should get out of that situation if you can. But where the tension starts to come in is that, and I've spoken to a lot of people about this. So when these people choose to leave their country, sometimes they're coming from Honduras, sometimes they're coming from Nicaragua, sometimes they're coming from Guatemala, Central America, maybe even South America. But they're often choosing to travel through lots of different countries, you know, and choosing to travel all the way to the United States, often thousands of miles. And you know, so there's people who I've spoken to who feel like that if they want to claim refugee status, then why don't they go to this first safest country? Now, you know, they should stop in, you know, if they're coming from Honduras, they should stop in Guatemala. If they're coming from Guatemala, they should stop in Mexico, you know, because these countries should theoretically are safer than where they came from. But And they're saying, why are they traveling thousands of miles to get to the United States? Well, so yeah, theoretically they're safer, but Mexico, in some parts of Mexico, it's categorized at the same level as some countries in the Middle East. They're level 3, level 4 travel advisories. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't necessarily say it's safer in some places. So it's understandable they're going to come all the way down here. Well, I believe 2016 was the first time we were introduced to the thought of migrating caravans. And forgive me if I get that year wrong, but I know it came twice, and it was a group of people from Honduras and Central America, and they migrated together and they made it to the United States, and it was used as a wedge issue at the time. You know, depending on the side of the political spectrum that you were on, it was either, you know, these migrant caravans are coming to storm our country, and we need to defend our borders, and you know, they're coming, you know, basically, I, for lack of a better term, I felt like they were just saying they took our jobs. So, and then the other side was, you know, oh, we need to care for these people, they're refugees. And, you know, and now here I am in the middle, and I'm like, I don't know what the best thing to do here is. Mm-hmm. So international law says that we have to take those people in. Mm-hmm. Well, Donald Trump gets elected, and he starts to say, you know what? At international law, nobody's really holding me to it, so we're gonna put in restrictions that will, for lack of a better term, and this is, here's, I'm gonna make an argument based on this one. So my argument is that these people's due process rights are being violated just for the fact that the way that the family separation was implemented, it was implemented as a way to punish people for coming to the United States and deter, as opposed to protect the children that they were supposedly protecting. So when Donald Trump came into office, he issued an executive order. Now, executive orders only function as law in the sense that for the administrative agencies under the directive of the executive branch, he is allowed to tell them how to do their jobs within the confines of the law. Mm-hmm. That's why, you know, during the Obama administration, he didn't really pursue low-level drug offenders, and he was more concerned with deporting people who were criminals than, you know, than people who just had regular jobs. Mm-hmm. So when Trump came in, he changed the directive for Department of Homeland Security and for Customs Border Patrol, and he told them, we want you to enforce it a little stricter. So at the border, they started separating children and family. So they would essentially give people a Sophie's choice. And that would be, you can either turn around and go home. So these are refugees. These are not, keep in mind, there's a very special distinction. Now, a lot of people are under the assumption that these are illegal immigrants coming in illegally, but these people are coming in from Central America and they're claiming refugee status. Under international law, we are to take them in. Now, under the Trump administration, he has directed them to separate the parents from the children and then has no way to monitor them and then will give them the choice. You can either go back to where you came from, you can choose to wait in Mexico with your family, or you can, we can imprison you here and we're going to separate you and your child. And oftentimes these, can just imagine yourself being put in a situation where you've traveled thousands of miles, you've escaped murder, you've escaped rape, you know, there's people along the way that have tried to hurt you, and you get to where you're supposed to be and you brought your child all that way, and now you're told you can go back, or work, or if you want to stay here, we're going to separate you from your child. And you know, a lot of these people made the choice, yes, but they didn't understand what they were doing, because oftentimes these people are not educated. You know, they come from these poor countries and they don't speak the language, and you know, our Customs and Border Patrol, they might not be bilingual either. So you know, they're making these difficult choices, and now these children are separated from their parents. And I mean, anybody with a basic understanding of psychology can tell you that's not a good thing, to separate your child from the parent at any point in their development cycle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so these children are being traumatized, and I've read story after story of not only the children being traumatized, but the parents being traumatized. In some instances, the parents have been deported and nobody has recorded, you know, who their child was. And the child has gone on to somebody in the United States, and the parent got deported to whatever country they came from, and now they can't find that parent. So, like, that child has lost their parent, and hopefully they find him. You know, the fact that this is happening in our name right now is just something I have a hard time accepting. And I feel like too many people were quick to brush it under the rug when shortly after the news stories came out of children in cages, the Trump administration directed another order and said, okay, we're not going to do that anymore. Yet it still continues. It hasn't stopped. You know, so it's... I'm wondering how this is going to be viewed in history, because, like, we have an example that has happened within the last 100 years. Mm-hmm. That, I mean, we look I look at with horror and disgust. You know, and that's during World War II, the internment of Japanese Americans for nothing more than they were Japanese Americans, and the Americans thought that they were spies for Japan. You know, we have an entire, you know, we have another time where we have stripped people of their rights that they were owed. And, you know, we've had to apologize for that since, but at the time, you know, people were behind it, and or people ignored it. And I feel like this is just another one of those times with the separation of parents and children that continues to the, and they're refugees. I just want to make sure that we're clear. Refugees, if we're abiding by international law, and that's a big if, you know, we're supposed to take them in. And we don't require too much proof. Most of the time, you know, they go through their vetting process, and you know, if they can prove, and most of the time they can, then they should be given passage here. Because, I mean, if we're purported to be the country that is, you know, always looking out for the humanitarian interests of the world, then how is it that we can turn people away, you know, when they're coming to us in their time of need? How is it that when they do come to us, we're causing them horrible trauma that's going to last lifetimes and may have long-term repercussions for the rest of us?
Yeah.
You know, how do we stand and live with that? So that's been something that's been very difficult for me, especially, you know, I'm a child, I'm an immigrant. Mm-hmm. And I know that, you know, that my mom, you know, she came here in the 70s, and I'm not sure if your listeners are aware, but in the 1980s, Reagan passed an amnesty. I think it was 1986, which allowed people like my mom, who had been here for 7 years, mm-hmm. you know, with no criminal record, to become, you know, resident alien, and for her to pay taxes and contribute to society and work towards her citizenship. And I'm lucky. I consider myself so lucky because I never had to worry that my mom was going to get deported when I was a kid. And there was cousins of mine that didn't have that same luxury. You know, they didn't have the luxury of, like, if the INS at the time, immigration, showed up at her job, you know, that she wasn't going to be going, having a free trip to Mexico. That, like, I had cousins that really had that fear. And I mean, you know, people out there these days still have that fear of their parent maybe getting deported. So
I mean, the family separation, like, I heard it started during the Obama administration, and I briefly watched, like, the Democratic debate, like, a couple of months ago. And they asked the question to Joe Biden, and there was, like, a woman that asked him this question, and she said, like, are you guys, like, your administration is responsible for, like, the most, like, deportations and, like, family mm-hmm. separations? And he couldn't even answer the question. like, because he knows it's true. And it's just, that's like another thing that, like, I wanted to point out, that it did start under his administration. And just the whole family separation, I mean, that's just, I can't imagine, like, going through that. Like, one, you don't speak any English, or you don't know anything about the culture, and you're going there and your family separated. Like, you don't know what the hell is going on. Like, the psychological trauma behind it, even like the immigration process is not easy. So, like, just even going through that is just so, so, so heavy. And I don't know. I just can't imagine dealing with something like that, not having your parent around, and or you're in the, and you end up living somewhere else. I don't know. I just can't imagine just going through something like that. Like, that is just absolutely traumatic.
Oh, absolutely. I just want to touch a couple things, because I believe, as far as the question goes for Joe Biden, so Obama was known as the deporter in chief because he was responsible for, you know, the most deportations under his tenure at the time. Mm-hmm. You know, in recent history. So I believe they may have been talking about family separation in that context, but the family separation that we know of now did not start until the Trump administration directed, I believe, the director of Homeland Security at the time, Kristen Nielsen, I think that was her name. She was the one that started it. Did not start under the Obama administration. Under the Obama administration, people came to port. They were allowed to wait in the country. That was when they came to refugee status. If they had family, they would allow them to wait with family while they processed their application. Yeah. So that was changed during the Trump administration.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I didn't know that. So thank you for clearing
sorry.
That.
It's just, I've looked into it a lot, and I wanted to make sure my facts are straight too. So.
Okay. Well, moving on to something else, maybe we can talk briefly about the pandemic. And since you have kids, and anyone who's listening that has kids, how is online learning going for you right now?
So I've been fortunate because my kids' school has been, you know, has had small classes, and we've been able to send them to school. Mm-hmm. But I do know of others who are still in the public school system and who are struggling with the requirements. So this has been a very interesting time with regards to being a parent and you know, the requirements and the things that we may have taken for granted as being a parent. School has been, so I've always understood the importance of school, and I've always understood, you know, how it's a societal good, and how having a school system and a public school system ensures that we have at least a baseline of intelligence throughout the society. You know, not everyone's going to be at that baseline, some people above and below, but for the most part, you can go up to someone in our society and have a functioning conversation with them if they went through our public school system. But now we're in a position where the parents have had to become the teachers, and the teachers are nothing more than invisible objects behind a screen. You know, I don't know how it's possible for a teacher who normally has a hard time getting a handle on up to 30 kids in the public school system in person, how they manage an online Zoom class. That to me sounds like total chaos, that there would be no order, that you'd probably have a certain percentage of the children that are doing the work, and then a certain percentage that will never do the work. And it falls on the parents to do this. So in Arizona, we are required to send our children to school for 180 days. It is a requirement by law. Now, certain exceptions can be made if your child has special needs or any other thing, and that's done on the individual basis. Mm-hmm. Now, when Governor Ducey came out in July, and everybody was waiting for him to talk about how schools were going, The reason people wanted him to take action was because he had certain powers that he could undertake during emergencies such as this one, and to cancel certain requirements. Now, one thing he could have done is he could have just, you know, said schools are closed indefinitely until we get a handle on the coronavirus. We're just not going to open schools. Now, that's the ideal situation, at least in my book, but that wasn't going to fly with anyone. And people want to send their kids to schools. Yeah. For whatever reason, it's interfering with people's work lives and it's interfering with their personal lives. You know, parents, and I mean, a lot more of them would admit it now, but parents like that break that they get, you know, to send their kids to school. They like the free daycare. You know, whatever, however they see school, it's used as a means so that they can go to work, do whatever tasks they need to get done throughout the day. Now that's been taken away from them. Now, and then add on top of that, now you're a teacher. Hey, by the way, you who has a high school education, or, you know, you went to school for engineering, you went to school to be a lawyer, you know, you're a teacher now. And it's absolutely impossible to expect anyone to succeed in that scenario. That is absolute chaos, because what the governor did was nothing. All he did was, we're going to close schools until August 17th. Mm-hmm. And then what he should have did was been like, we're going to put a directive in order. We're going to have a plan in place, and we are going to make it so that there's no guesswork. Every school district in the state, however many there are in the state, has a plan of action. We all follow this. We all get through this together. You know, everything's good. You know, to a lesser extent, he could have canceled the requirement of 180 days of in-school education, because what's happening now is people are making the choice of working or sending their kids to school.
Yeah.
I do know of people who are struggling with their daycares excuse me, because their daycares have now been turned into makeshift schools, and they're not equipped. The daycares are not equipped with the staff to facilitate what they're being asked to do. The children are being asked to learn on their computer, and these children range in age from anywhere from 4 to 12, and the daycare workers can't keep up with everyone. They can't help everyone. And at the end of the day, the kids end up missing out because they'll get sent home if they don't do their work. Mm-hmm. And now if the child gets sent home, well, the parent has to go pick them up. And now their earning power is diminished because they have to go get their kid from preschool or from the daycare, get out of work, miss a day of work now, and now they're behind. All because, you know, if Ducey would have just canceled the requirement for in-school instruction, and had he done anything, really, instead of what he did, you know, these people could have made the decision of, you know what, my choice is this. My choice is send my kids to school or stay home from work, not earn any money, and make sure my kids go to school. Or, well, I'm a single parent. I can't really, you know, take time out of my work, and I really need to make sure I can feed my kids.
Yeah.
Now I need to go to work, and because I really honestly don't feel like the children are going to miss out, you know, for the next 2 years if they don't go to school. Because, like, the WHO recently came out and said that, you know, the coronavirus is expected to last for another 2 years, with or without, you know, a vaccine. And if you look back to the previous pandemic of 1918, the Spanish flu, that one lasted about 2 years before everything was said and done. So if we take that timeline, you know, kids missing out 2 years out of school, you know, and if they suspend that requirement, it essentially makes school optional. The people that can send their kids to school can. And yeah, that's going to contribute to the class divide. Yeah, there's going to be some people who ultimately can't, you know, can't, they're single parents and they're kind of in a bad position. But I honestly think it's just the best way forward, because look at it now. It's complete piecework. It's every man out for themselves. You know, I'm the head of a household. And if I need something done, and if it's a crisis situation, I need all hands on deck, and there has to be one plan in place so that we can get through this. I wouldn't expect my children to be able to come up. Like, if I had a crisis plan that had come through in my house, I wouldn't expect my children to be able to come with a cohesive crisis plan, because they look to me for leadership. Yeah. That's exactly what these school districts are doing here. You know, obviously Queen Creek District, you know, you hear about them on the news. You know, Scottsdale School District, you don't hear so much about them on the news. Like all these other school districts, you hear about them on the news, but like, can you blame them? Mm-hmm. They were left on their own. They were given no guidance, and they were told, hey, you know, you Queen Creek School District, you may or may not have, you know, somebody with a medical degree on staff. Figure it out. Like, it's ridiculous. So I'm at the point where we're causing damage to ourselves. You know, people are going to get evicted because they made the choice that they think that their kid needs to go to school is more important than they're going to work, and they're homeless because they can't work. Mm-hmm. So I'm, as a parent, that's been my concern, is it really that important to send our kids to school during this time? We've been trying to push to get back to normal, but I think people just need to realize we're not normal anymore. We need to figure out a new normal. You know, we need to figure out what's life going to be like in 2 years. I don't know what's life going to be like in 2 years. I didn't realize that, you know, we'd be wearing face masks now. I thought, you know, it's going to go away. You know, in February, March, it started to become a little bit more serious, and here we are. You can't go anywhere without a face mask. So, I mean, as a parent, I just hope they just suspend the requirement for school. And the governor does have some leadership, because he's left a lot of people high and dry, and there's a lot of people suffering because of it.
Yeah, I think now it's just, we have to just pay attention to our leaders and like what they're doing. And I think there's just like, they have to know that this is just causing damage. Like, that's the thing. Like, I feel like they know, but they're making it like very hard for people like you, for anyone else that's listening and experiencing this. And obviously, you know, we want, like, you know, a good education for our kids, but is it worth it for everyone to be evicted or have nowhere to go? And I don't know, it's a very weird time, and I just hope we can all get through it.
I hope so too.
Yeah.
It's definitely more concerning when you realize that a lot of the jobs that were lost just won't be coming back. So
yeah, I mean, a lot of these companies, like these major companies, are pretty much like at a downfall. Like, a lot of them are already claiming bankruptcy at this point. So
I know it's we got to strap in for the long haul, but
yes. But just ending it on a positive note, what are some, I guess, some tips you can give to someone how to cultivate through this, like through these hard times? What could you give?
Honestly, I'm glad you asked that, because this is definitely something that's been on my mind. Mm-hmm. Well, this is really a good time to sharpen the saw, so to speak. And so the labor market is changing. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the jobs that were there aren't there anymore. And for the people who are finding themselves, you know, out of work or in between jobs, or working a job that, you know, just to pay the bills, you know, this is really a good time to contemplate whether you want to go back to school or go to a trade school or do something. Because the reality is, the value of a high school diploma keeps plummeting every year. Mm-hmm. And for that reason, I feel like that's why we're in the situation we're in now, where a lot of people were, you know, doing really well for themselves out of high school. And lo and behold, economy, it just takes a hit, and you know, they're at the bottom of the totem pole. So you want to definitely protect yourself against something like that, because this kind of a situation I've lived, this is the second time I've been through economic unrest. Mm-hmm. The first time I was the housing crisis of 2008. And, you know, during that time, I went to school and I bettered myself, and, you know, I'm in a good position now. And I'm looking back to that time to see, well, what did I do back then that really positioned me to get to where I'm at now? And mm-hmm. That's where I'm doing that too. I'm sharpening the saw. So, you know, if you wanted to learn a hobby, it's a good time. You know, it's a good time to, if you never played video games, play video games. If you wanted to sew, you know, pick up sewing, whatever you want to do, because we're in it for the long haul and we have to change the way we were. Oh, I was thinking about it in the sense of, I used to go out all the time. I used to hang out with friends. I used to go, you know, be very, very social, and that's not going to happen anymore. So we need to figure out what's the different way. What we can FaceTime with our friends, you know, that's great. We can play video games online with our friends. You know, people have come up with inventive things. You know, there's the Zoom calls. Everybody has their Zoom happy hour, which I think that's a pretty awesome concept. You know, mm-hmm. Even though you're not together, you're not drinking alone. You know, I mean, we can get run into trouble with that kind of thing. But, you know, we got to figure out ways to stay positive, because I'll be honest, I've been feeling the weight of all of this. And mm-hmm. I know I'm not the only one. I know maybe your listeners have been feeling like, you know, it's never going to end. And, you know, even getting professional help isn't a bad idea. There's sometimes, you know, sometimes you feel like you just can't get out of the funk here. Maybe talking to a professional too would not be a bad idea. Meditation, that's something I've been trying to get into myself. I was told that by a professor one time, that meditation really saved his life, because he had a heart attack, and because he was just a very tense person, mm-hmm. had a heart attack, and realized shortly after that, you know, he was just living his life too hard, and he needed to take time for himself. So
yeah, sometimes life is not hard. Like, I wouldn't say, I'm trying to like word it the best way I can, but I feel like we create the life that we build, if that makes sense. Like, if he was, you know, he was so tense and he had a heart attack. And I think sometimes we do take life too seriously, and we just really have to look at the positive aspect of certain things. Like, maybe there's, like, I went through this thing where financially, like, I wasn't doing well, but I look back and I was like, okay, well, what am I doing well right now? Okay, it's like, okay, I have a good family. I have a roof under me. I have like a partner that cares about me. And then after that, like, more, I would say positive things started happening, and I actually was better financially. So it's just like those type of things, like kind of like reprogramming your mind can really help during this time. And I think because of all these businesses crashing and things going on, like, honestly, I feel like 80% of people that go to like a lot of their jobs are unhappy. And I think it's a wake up call. Like, how can we make more income? Like, there's different ways to make income, like online, starting your own business, like figuring out those type of things, and it could really cultivate to what you want to do instead of just going to your job that you are normally going to and kind of slaving over a boss that, you know, you might stay, and he, you know, you're easily replaceable in that sense.
Right, just a drone, another cog in the wheel.
Yeah,
cog in that machine. Now, that's really what I'm trying to get at, is that this is definitely the time where if you are miserable in your job, you know, do something about it. It doesn't help. I've learned that it just doesn't help to complain. You know, I mean, it's okay to complain to yourself, because at least it makes you aware of what you're not happy with. Mm-hmm. But I mean, complaining to other people, they don't want to hear it.
They don't.
They know. I mean, we've all been around those people who just complain, and, oh, this is wrong, and that's wrong, and this mm-hmm. and that. And you're just like, get away from me, black cloud. I don't want to talk to you.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, this is definitely a good time to evaluate. Have I been a black cloud? Maybe, you know, maybe my there's a reason why, you know, nobody wants to hang out with me. It's definitely a good time for self-reflection. Good time for getting better, being a better person, getting in shape, reading a book, you know, small. I think it's funny when people think about goal setting. They think about such big things like, I want to buy a house in 10 years or I want to finish school in 5 years. But there's such things as small goals that you can do every morning. Like, I want to pack my lunch for work. That's a small goal. You know, that's so silly and insignificant, but you accomplished it. And it builds on that sense of accomplishment. It makes you feel like you can do those bigger things.
Right.
So, I mean, I guess that's one thing is that for those of you that are goal setters, don't set goals that are too extravagant. If you're just starting, you know, set yourself up for success. Don't set yourself up for failure. I mean, getting out of bed, if that's a goal, that's a goal. You know, brushing your teeth, if that's a goal, that's a goal. You've accomplished it. Make yourself feel good about the things that you do, because if you feel good about it, you're more likely to keep going.
Yeah, well, I think like when people set like very big goals, like, okay, like in the next 2 years, I want to be a millionaire. And then in 2 years, like it doesn't happen. And then they get like super upset and things like that. And I think it's just like, that's not really setting yourself up for success. It's like, maybe if you want to like be a millionaire, well, why don't you start with like small goals a month? Like, I want to make like 2,000. Or the next 3 months, like 2,000 a month, I mean, or the next 3 months, like, okay, I want to make maybe like 4,000 a month. And then like, just kind of like progress and keep progressing after that. And you need to have like an end goal to it and certain goals as well.
Right. It's all small goal setting, because there's the big goal, but as you had mentioned, there's small goals that get you along the way, mm-hmm. you know? It's like, I want to buy a car. Okay, well, I need to set aside this much money for the next following months.
Yeah.
And then, you know, that small goal leads you to those bigger goals.
Yeah, definitely being specific, that's for sure. You have to be specific in what your goals are to get to a bigger goal.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you for your time, and it was a good conversation, and I hope you have a good night.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate the conversation, Margaret.
Yeah, thank you. Bye-bye.
Have a great day. Bye-bye.